Well, I have to say that for all the talk of feeling depressed, I'm actually feeling pretty great. Because what I've gathered so far is that we shouldn't pick our fights and try to win based on money and lobbyists. And we don't have money and lobbyists. Secondly, we shouldn't try to win based on approaches developed by staff. Well, we don't have staff. All we have is members. So maybe we can win based on members. And that's what I'd like to talk about today, is the gains that have come about in the Gulf Coast since Katrina because of member organizing, because of worker organizing. I work with the New Orleans Worker Center for Racial Justice. Very quickly, worker centers exist precisely because a large number of workers were left out of the New Deal. And today, the people who are organized into worker centers are in large part the people we're talking about when we talk about the future of the labor movement. Day laborers who stand on street corners looking for work, who have organized into a national federation. Domestic workers who work in households who have organized into a national federation. Guest workers, who I'll be talking about a little bit, who are workers who are now in an organized fashion fighting for the right to be recognized under the 13th Amendment, who are organized into an emerging national alliance. Farm workers and others who have, for the last many years, tried to organize outside of the labor movement very powerfully, and in some cases, gotten to the point where they can have partnerships with the labor movement to move labor to the left and to move labor not only to the left, really, but to move labor to the bottom so that there can be a bottom-up approach to worker organizing again. So I just want to give two or three points of context. Firstly, after Katrina, what we saw was the past 30 years of American history repeated over again in about 6 months. It was the United States in microcosm. Very soon after Katrina, a large number of African American workers were displaced, and a large number of immigrant workers were brought in to replace them. African American workers were locked out because of public policy, and immigrant workers were brought in. The local workers, immediately after Katrina, found themselves racially excluded from the Reconstruction. Immigrant workers were brought in and found themselves included but racially exploited. And so you had a very stark and clear racial landscape where one group of workers was locked out, another was locked in, and US public policy locked these workers into competition with each other. 6 months after Hurricane Katrina, there was still a debate about whether poor people would be allowed to return, but there was no debate about whether affirmative action in contracting would be suspended by the White House, it was, by executive order, and whether the Prevailing Wage Act would be suspended, it was. The Davis-Bacon Act, 6 months later, was suspended by the White House by executive order. And what it set up then was a labor context in which public policy had created a race to the bottom. And in many ways, we're still dealing with that race to the bottom. A few years later, we have the recession, which, you know, wasn't really that transformative for poor people. Poor people have been in recession for a long time. It was certainly a very transformative experience for public officials, people in Washington, who suddenly had a name for the experience that many Americans were going through. And with these two events in backdrop, two stories of worker organizing are particularly compelling and give instruction, I think, to what can happen when workers really take hold and decide to transform their workplaces and their communities. Soon after Katrina, in a hotel called the Astor Crown Plaza, which was the flagship hotel of a very large and wealthy New Orleans hotel chain, a large number of guest workers appeared from Peru, Bolivia, and the Dominican Republic. This hotel had received multi-million dollar contracts from FEMA to house African-American workers who didn't have a place to go. All of these men and women were looking for jobs. At that time that the Astor Crown Plaza was home to these unemployed, poor, working-class African-American families, the Astor Crown Plaza told the Department of Labor that they couldn't find a single U.S. worker, willing or able, to be a receptionist, a front desk clerk, or a maintenance clerk. So they got recruiters, the Department of Labor, of course, agreed. They got recruiters to go to these countries and bring back guest workers. We started organizing the guest workers and eventually the workers in the hotels. Guest workers come into the U.S. through the guest worker program on H-2B visas. The visa prohibits you from switching employers and says that if you leave the job, you can be deported within 10 days of leaving your employer. In essence, the guest worker program means you do not have the right to quit and you do not have the right to change employers. And in effect, what that means is that you do not have the right to organize. That's not explicitly written down, but that's in effect what it means. So we decided to build an organization of guest workers out of the campaign from the Astor Crown Plaza. 6 months later, we had a membership organization of guest workers called the Alliance of Guest Workers for Dignity, which is based on the abolitionist principle that workers have to have the right to transform their workplace if they're to be called free. And if they don't have the right to transform their workplace without being fired and deported back into virtual debt slavery, then they're not free. And freedom means collective freedom. It means the collective right to fight with your employer. We formed the Alliance of Guest Workers, in 2007. A few years later, we had a campaign in Tennessee that's equally instructive. At about the same time that the recession was unfolding over Tennessee, an employer called Gary Lang decided that he didn't want to hire American workers for his construction jobs, and he didn't want to go to the union. So he brought workers who paid $5,000 apiece to labor recruiters and put their homes in collateral against the right to work. He brought them over, and he, after they came to Nashville, told them that it would be another $2,500 in order for them to work, which would be, in order to make it easy for them, he would just deduct it from their paychecks. He then leased them for a profit across military bases and other public projects across 7 states. And when we started organizing these workers, they reported to us that they were having to pay to work in Nashville and then find somehow the ability to transport themselves to Texas or other places to do this work. Workers decided to go on strike, and we got from the Department of Labor the roster of American workers who had been interviewed for these jobs and who weren't hired for these jobs. So along with the immigrant workers, with the guest workers, we door-knocked all of these American workers, and we had one workers' rights board hearing with Jobs with Justice, with the unions in the room and clergy in the room, about the fact that American workers were being denied these jobs while guest workers were being exploited. And all the while, this labor recruiter was posing as an employer and defrauding the US government with impunity. The story created a real transformation, I believe, among the labor leadership in Tennessee, which defended the workers' strike, joined them in congressional visits, and is still continuing to work on the campaign of these workers. I think these two stories are instructive because it shows that when workers organize and are in motion, it has the ability not only to change a dynamic with an employer, but to really take labor leaders through a conversion experience and to change the popular discourse about what's possible and about where the fight is in the labor movement. The reality is that the labor movement in the United States predated the trade union movement by many years. And one of the gains of the labor movement was the 13th Amendment, which gives workers the right to fight involuntary servitude. For our work in New Orleans and across the Gulf Coast, the work of Jim Pope actually has been very instructive. We came upon about a year into our organizing, we almost accidentally came upon an essay that he wrote in the New Labor Forum that talked about the fact that labor law can't be the premise of worker organizing alone in this country, particularly since the National Labor Relations Act is predicated on the Commerce Clause. In other words, workers have the right to strike and stop a strike only in relation to the need for commerce to continue, not in relation to the need for workers to be free. We started to organize metal workers under this context very intentionally about 3 years ago. We decided that because of the extraordinarily coercive relationship between recruiters and employers in the metal trades and guest workers coming in to do metal trades work, that this was really a sector where we could try out this idea. But not only that, this was the idea that workers were talking about. When we went into labor camps to organize workers, they weren't talking about how to get a raise, and they weren't talking about how to improve conditions. They were talking about wanting to be free. And they said, we're not slaves. And when we took, in the middle of the night, these workers out of labor camps into FEMA trailer parks where unemployed and displaced African-American workers were staying, a lot of times the following conversation would occur. Workers in our membership would sit down with African-American workers who had been unemployed and displaced after Katrina. And a lot of these immigrant workers would say, you know what? If only we had legal papers, if only we had citizenship, all our problems would be over. And the African-American workers said, you know what? We got our legal papers, and we got our citizenship, and look at how it turned out for us. And so, in a sense, a lot of transformative conversations started with the workers really expressing something bigger that they wanted, something more basic than just the right to sit down and have an agreement with an employer. They were expressing the desire to be free. And the African-American community, which is also part of our membership, didn't say, you don't have the right to say this is involuntary servitude. Instead, they said, you know what? That reminds us of what's been going on down here for a long time. On that basis, and on the basis of many conversations, we created a theory. And the theory was essentially that the guest worker program, because it does not allow workers to switch employers, because it doesn't give you the right to quit, and because it means that you'll be deported when you're fired, is a violation of the 13th Amendment. Recently, Jim Pope helped us articulate that argument for the U.S. government, and the U.S. government, in the past few weeks, in a watershed decision, agreed with us and granted protections to our members based on this intellectual argument. Now, I'm simplifying, of course, a little bit. But I think it is a real example of how 3 years of organizing and how collaborations between workers, worker centers, unions, and people who have done exemplary research and analysis in academic institutions can really come together to change something that may not have been able to happen, 3 years ago under a different administration. Certainly, there's things that there's lots of reasons why we're not happy with this administration. But there are opportunities that I think if we, if we spend too much time in the daylight, at least. I mean, when it's dark, of course, we should go to bars and gripe about it. But when we're at work, I think if we spend too much time, feeling under the weight of all of the things that haven't happened, we miss opportunities like this to fight for things that can happen. I'll end here, but I just want to close by saying that by the end of this year, we will have a dues-paying permanent organization of guest workers who will be joining other organized workers in the informal sector for the bigger, broader fight for the next 3 years. And that will be a fight not only for workplace rights, but for new legal definition, a new discourse, and new forms of resistance and protest that only workers can carry out, but that all of us in this room can support. I'll hope you'll be with us then. Thank you.
Thank you, Saket. Thank you, thank you.